ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Hello there, I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Hamish McDonald.
Now, in this episode, we're taking questions from you again. We're going to reflect the inbox full of questions that we have from you asking us to explore Indonesia and the region. So we're doing just that. And you know, Hamish, I might just find out what you think about a few things.
Never, Geraldine. You'll never know what I genuinely think. Amanda Hodge, the Australian's long-serving Asia editor, will be on hand to talk us through some, frankly, seismic changes underway in our region.
Such as why Indonesia is sending troops to Gaza.
That's all coming up on Global Roaming, your call.
Yes, we really have had so many requests to talk about Indonesia and the region, Hamish. So that's what we're going to try to really focus on today.
A swathe of election results in Thailand, big result in Bangladesh, of course, a complicated history there, and then a huge election result in Japan as well. Closer to us, Indonesia, something I think worth taking a bit of a look at.
As someone who's going to Indonesia, as you told us last week, soon, you're going to land at an interesting time in this place's life, given that they're now, well, there's a lot of debate about how many troops they do plan to send to that stabilisation force in Gaza.
Now, this international stabilisation force has been mandated by the UN's Security Council by way of a resolution last year. Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto hasn't spoken publicly about this latest development, and exactly what Indonesia's role in peacekeeping would look like is still unclear.
Yeah, and look, Prabowo has copped a bit of flack domestically in Indonesia for some of the things he's been intimating in relation to Gaza. Of course, it's the world's most populous Muslim-dominated democracy. And Prabowo, the president, has agreed to join Trump's Board of Peace. And, you know, remember, there's plenty of countries in the Arab world that have said they won't contribute troops to whatever happens as part of this international stabilization force. So it's certainly going out on a limb for a relatively new president. Don't forget, though, of course, he was the defense minister. So he's, you know, he feels attached to these issues and, you know, is one of these leaders that has seen or has a view that Indonesia can play a bigger role on the international stage. But certainly, I think it will be complicated, you know, in practice, but also domestically and politically as well.
Oh, I think it's quite significant, actually, watching. I'm sure they're putting themselves through hoops. And maybe that's just a perfect place to introduce our guest, because she lived in Indonesia for 9 years and sort of has absorbed herself in all matters Indonesian and Asian. Amanda Hodge is joining us now. We're really delighted to welcome her. She's the Asia-Pacific correspondent for The Australian with 2 decades of experience reporting on South and Southeast Asia. She's back in Australia now as a roving reporter for The Oz. Amanda, welcome.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Those politics that Hamish referred to, that must be pretty tricky for Prabowo. I mean, they keep downgrading the numbers of troops they allegedly plan to send. Yeah. Do I take that as code for, you know, a concerned population? How would you read it?
Yeah, look, I think it's a bit of that, but it's also nobody knows what Prabowo actually is thinking or what he's going to do, and his decisions change depending on the last person he spoke to. So, you know, back in November, he talked about 20,000 troops. I don't think anybody ever believed Indonesia was going to stump up 20,000 troops for a stabilization force in Gaza, given the almost universal support in Indonesia for a Palestinian state and the widespread concern that Indonesian troops would end up having to, you know, go head to head with Hamas or, you know, any other Palestinian rebel group. So earlier this week, there was a figure of 8,000. That's, you know, I think as recently as yesterday, in the DPR, which is the lower house of parliament, there was a foreign policy commission meeting, and the deputy defence minister mentioned a figure of around 600 to 800. So we're going down pretty rapidly. You know, the defence minister has said that these troops are, there are a number of troops, thousands of troops being readied. What that actually means, we don't really know. And nothing will be decided until after President Prabowo Subianto goes to Washington next week for the Board of Peace meeting.
Well, one assumes there'll be a range of things waved in front of Subianto's nose and Indonesia's nose, surely.
The tariff issue is a live one. Prabowo was seen to have dropped the ball on the tariffs, and he ended up with a 19% figure that no one was particularly happy with. There's some suggestion that this offer of stabilisation troops for Gaza could be some sort of a leverage or a quid pro quo that helps to whittle down this 19% tariff, though that would be very unpopular back in Indonesia because, of course, it's, you know, it's a non-negotiable for Indonesians. The idea of defending colonised nations is enshrined in the constitution. You know, you don't mess with that, and you certainly don't bargain with it. So if it is a quid pro quo or leverage, no one's going to say that outright, certainly not within the Istana.
Can you see anybody putting up their hand, in effect, in Indonesia, other politicians, to align themselves more with Trump? Is there a sort of a live energy there or not?
Look, I think like a lot of ASEAN nations, Indonesia's preferred position is to straddle to both great powers, right? Mm. I mean, it is working very hard to build further business, trade, economic ties with China, which is its future right now. And obviously it also needs the US economically, but also for that historic security guarantee in the region, which has, you know, which is worth less and less over time, which has been sort of devalued by Trump's rhetoric towards allies and partners in the region. Everyone knows they need to keep Trump on side. It's just how much they are willing to give in order to maintain that status quo.
Okay, well, look, I mean, that's just part of the story of what's unfolding in Asia at the moment. It's a bit like democracy peak hour in a way for the region elections.
Or new conservatism peak hour.
Well, yes. I mean, these two dramatic gambles by people both in Japan and in Thailand, these snap elections, which are big risks, and they have paid off big time for the people who've taken them. Now, I'll leave it to you. Do you want to start with Thailand before we get to the extraordinary impact in Japan of these elections?
Yeah, look, Thailand was a very interesting one.
Anutin Chanvirakul came to power in September last year as caretaker prime minister after the ousting of Pethongtan Shinawat. He called a snap general election after just 100 days in office.
But in a surprise move, caretaker Prime Minister Anutin Chanvirakul and his Bumjai Thai Conservative Party has claimed that they do have the support and they do have enough numbers to form the next government. A lot of nationalistic sentiment and Anutin's strong stance against Cambodia really fueled support for the party in the final weeks ahead of these elections.
It was such a shocking result for Thailand, right? I mean, the progressives have been on this wave of popularity since they sort of came on the scene in 2017. And that was still under the old kind of proxy military regime, right? They'd sort of taken off their uniform, but it was still a junta. And the young people in particular had had quite enough of that. So this progressive movement grew out of that. There was this push to reform lots of things about Thailand, which is a very moribund economy. Mm. It's very, you know, captive to the royalist military establishment. And in the 2023 election, they came first. But of course, as always, the establishment found a way to, you know, subvert the will of the people, and they weren't able to form government. But this election, we had Anutin Chanvirakul, who was only just became prime minister in September. You know, he's got a lot of baggage. He didn't do well managing the floods at the end of last year. You know, he's the cannabis king who mismanaged legalizing the medical marijuana industry in Thailand. He had a lot of baggage, right? But he's very good at networking. And, you know, in the midst of this snap poll that he called, there's also this ongoing border stoush with Cambodia. Mm. And there's no better time to, you know, cement the conservative vote than during an ongoing conflict. And I think that's what we saw this election. I think voters probably were also a bit pragmatic. They realised that, you know, they couldn't keep voting for a progressive movement that was always going to be subverted. So they went for perhaps the middle path. You know, I think this has clipped the wings of the progressives. I certainly don't think it's ended their journey. But this is the first conservative victory, genuine conservative victory in Thailand since about the 1970s. So it's really quite something.
And I mean, you know, the key question, how much will this change in the weeks to come, the months to come, our relationships with these places? I mean, that's what, you know, stands out. Are we facing a very different region or not?
I don't think it changes at all our relationship with Thailand. In some ways, this is just the status quo, because even if, you know, the progressives were to have won again, they wouldn't have been able to form power. In some ways, this is the best outcome for Thailand, because for the first time in so many decades, the conservatives and the royalist establishment has the popular mandate. It also has the imprimatur of the establishment, and that equals stability, right? And what they really need right now is stability to right the economic, the flagging economy, basically.
Amanda, there's plenty of elections unfolding, but I think for the region, the result in the Japanese election is really probably the most seismic.
Well, Sanae Takaichi has led her Liberal Democratic Party to a historic landslide win after the weekend general election. The LDP has secured more than two-thirds of the 465 seats in Japan's parliament.
Sanae Takaichi is a conservative leader governing the Liberal Democratic Party, and she's also become well known for her nationalistic rhetoric, including taking a stronger position pushing back against China and accelerating military spending. All moves that appear to have energised the public.
Can you talk through for listeners why the scale of this election victory might have an impact on the shape of our region?
Yeah. I mean, like Geraldine said, snap polls are so risky, right? And ahead of this election, there was talk
she'd only
about,
been in for 3 months, right?
Right. She'd only been in for 3 months, just like Anutin in Thailand. So there was some suggestion that there was voter resentment at her going to the polls so quickly because it's expensive, right? Mm. And that was going to, you know, kick back on her. But obviously it hasn't. She's got this supermajority, more than two-thirds.
The LDP has never had this result since it was formed in Japan. So it's quite amazing.
It's remarkable. And, I mean, now that she's got this two-thirds majority, more than two-thirds majority, Sanae Takaichi can change the constitution. And the thing about the constitution that particularly young voters in Japan would like to see changed is the Article 9 of the constitution, which essentially restricts Japan's sovereign right to go to war, right? And this has been an ongoing conversation and debate in Japan for a long time. And, you know, it was Takaichi's mentor, Abe, who first started pushing on this. But she now has a clear path to change that if she wants. She went to the election promising to increase spending on intelligence and defence, and she can go ahead and do that.
Is it a clear path, though? Like, I've been reading about the actual mechanics of changing the Japanese constitution. She still does have to go through multiple processes to get there. It's not a fait accompli, is it?
It's not a fait accompli. And, in fact, you know, I don't think she's going to jump into that first. She's already, you know, she has already said what she wants to do, and that is, you know, lift defence, lift intelligence capabilities. And that is good for us. That is good for the region. It is good for another middle power, although she sees Japan as a great power, not a middle power. It's good for the region that another middle power is willing, you know, to stand up and stand up to China. And that's good for Australia. It's good for the Five Eyes.
Is there a dangerous side to that, though, right? Because I've read a lot about her fondness for referring to Japan's military defeat of Russia, you know, at the turn of the last century, its capacity to defeat the Chinese. I mean, this is serious stuff, and you've got a leader there that somehow has kind of an emotional connection, I suppose, with that narrative and seems to want to re-establish Japan along those lines in terms of the kind of counterweights that exist in the region. That doesn't come without risks for us.
Well, in fact, Michael Green from the US Study Centre in Sydney, who said he's known Sané, he was posted there for many years, very, very well. And he reads her as essentially doubling down on the US. So while other people are doing, you know, listening to Mark Carney saying we've got to stand back, and we certainly are, you know, it's subterranean, but you can just feel the doubts creeping in Australia. He reads the way she is behaving as doubling down, making herself indispensable or perceived to be indispensable to the United States.
But Japan is indispensable to the United States.
But you never know where they are these days. And that's the point. So the question is, does it make it harder for us in Australia? Because we're trying to strike a very different tone with China. And here we'll have this woman in at the moment. I mean, I think she's going to be an incredible challenge for Australian foreign affairs. Who appears to be running a very different race. So I think there's lots of question marks about how this is going to play out.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's, for sure, it's conditional on, you know, how great her ambition is, right? And whether we start to see this sort of strain of neo-imperialism coming in. I mean, that's obviously always a concern. But, Japan is coming from a long way back. And, you know, if this refrain is limited to, you know, the importance of middle powers in the region, which is, you know, what Penny Wong always talks about, and defending this so-called, you know, rules-based order that Mark Carney kind of unclothed, you know, recently, then that is a good thing. You know, building intelligence capabilities that, you know, meet the standards of Five Eyes is useful.
Amanda, you mentioned the enormous popularity that Sanae Takeuchi enjoys amongst the younger population in Japan. Those demographics swung strongly in behind the LDP according to the way the votes went. There's a kind of celebrity dimension to her, clearly, like her handbags are being bought by young Japanese women. People are buying the pink pen that she uses. We've talked in the past about the sort of social media persona that she seems to have developed. But do you have any sense of whether those younger demographics are also swinging in behind some of these more nationalist ideas? Like, do they want to abandon the pacifist constitution? Because I guess there's a part of it that doesn't quite make sense to me, which is that actually Japan's found a way to navigate around that language in its constitution anyway.
Yeah. I just think there is a, you know, a level of concern about China in the region and in Japan as well, that, you know, that young people are not immune from, you know, immune to. They are also concerned about China's rise. They hear the sort of muscular to and fro between Japan and China, and it worries them. They're worried about, you know, North Korea's missile capacity. They're not immune to that. And so I don't think they want to be a neo-imperialist power. I don't think they're I don't think there's a huge wave of support for, you know, Japan suddenly becoming a war-capable nation. But I think they want to feel like they can properly defend themselves, like they're not sitting out there like a shag on a rock.
And, you know, it's very interesting. The other part of that she is committed to is massively stimulating the economy. Now, we were told by Peter Varghese in our very good summer series that actually your ability to behave geopolitically is very much geared to your economic strength. And at the moment, Japan is capital everywhere. You know, that they're massively important in the bond markets around the world and across border flows and so on. But their economy is very stuck fast. And she is trying to sort of burst it open so that it's got a vigour to it. But, you know, the bond markets may not like that. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of cross currents there that she's going to have to navigate. And those young people you're talking about are going to have to also work out how it plays out in their society, which is pretty, there's a lot of rigidities there. So that's something I'm also going to be alert to very much, its impact on the economy.
Japan's a bit of a paradox, though, because it's been stuck economically, you know, for a long
years,
time.
Indeed.
But if you travel around the region, not just Southeast Asia, but South Asia, you see Japan's stamp everywhere. You know, it is it's like a huge aid donor, development a partner across the region. I mean, Kabul Airport was, you know, built by or at least sponsored by Japan. You see it in Bangladesh. You see it all over. It has been able to maintain its influence throughout the region, without, you know, having a very dynamic economy.
Hello.
Questions to the Prime Minister.
I don't know anything about it. I'd have to check, but we'll get back to you on that.
Hello, good afternoon. It's Boris Johnson here.
Thanks for your inquiry, but I'm not going to comment.
Please explain.
All right, I think this is a good opportunity for us to jump into a listener question. This question comes from Helene. Thanks very much for writing in. I recently read an interesting report from the British government titled Global Biodiversity Loss, Ecosystem Collapse and National Security. The take-home message is that predicted ecosystem collapses that are linked to global warming threatens food security in the UK. Helen says, I think this is a very interesting topic to explore more. There are many countries, particularly developing countries, that will be similarly affected. As far as I'm aware, your program hasn't really explored this link. Amanda, a country that comes to mind when I read that email is Indonesia, where you've spent lots of time. How do you interpret that?
For Indonesia, food security is number one almost, you know, and it underpins one of Prabowo Subianto, the president's big priority policies in Indonesia, which is food estates, making sure that Indonesia always has enough food. But Australia actually plays a really big role in shoring up food security across the region, because it not only helps with mitigating shortages through our own agricultural produce, but it also helps modernize agriculture in countries like Indonesia, in Bangladesh, you know, in Pakistan. You see, you know, those agencies everywhere helping to build productivity in the agricultural sector. So we're already doing that. We're already seen as an agricultural superpower in the region. But when you look at events like that catastrophic series of floods in North Sumatra and Aceh last year, I mean, I think most people would remember seeing those incredible pictures and footage of this sort of tsunami of logs, you know, washing down, not only stripping the country, but killing hundreds of people in its wake. And subsequent to those events, there's been so much debate about rampant deforestation, not just for plantations, you know, palm plantations, timber plantations, but food estates. Ill-advised food estates that just kind of clear millions of hectares, like what's happening in Papua at the moment, 2 million hectares being cleared for food estates with no real idea of whether those food estates are actually going to work, whether what they're planting is suitable for the climate and the, you know, topography of where they're putting them. It's
See, I think the subtext of Helene's question, and we've had several over the 2 years we've been alive, Amanda, is where is the environment and biodiversity, but particularly the sort of environmental discussion in this whole febrile international climate at the moment, you know? And like, it's not there. We don't hear it much at all, do we? And yet we did a couple of years ago. You know, even Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, the big investment firm, I think there was that sort of vital message that he sent 2 years ago to all his various funds saying, climate, we've got to focus on climate and all our funds will do so. There he was, basically running Davos this week, and it was barely mentioned. So, yeah. I mean, it is difficult in such, with so much shifting and unsure for climate to have its own place at the table.
My sense is climate is not a popular subject at the moment with the way, you know, the world is moving. It's almost like when we talk about rampant deforestation and, you know, unchecked development, it's like a code for what is happening, you know, because this catastrophic kind of meeting of like severe climate events and unchecked development are what is causing, you know, all this devastation in not just Indonesia, in Sri Lanka, you know, I mean, we see it year after year, but what's being done about it and, you know, how does climate affect that? Well, obviously we're seeing more severe weather events more regularly, but you know, I think the way to talk about it palatably, the way environmentalists understand they need to talk about it to get some traction is to discuss it in the context.
But I also think, though, the economic data out of Southeast Asia and also the way we tell the story of it is one of rapid and massive development. You're kind of almost left with the image of everyone living in these brand new cities. But actually, as you travel around Southeast Asia, you see how uneven that is. And actually, there's still a lot of people, like very significant numbers of people, living essentially in subsistence farming.
Yeah. I mean, you hear a lot about the Asian century, but in actual fact, in a lot of these countries, the middle class is going backwards, right? There's a shrinking middle class, certainly in Indonesia, that's not getting the traction it should. And, on the climate issue, I think in some ways it's almost useful that when we talked about climate previously, it became this gigantic kind of catch-all for everything, right? But having to be more specific about what the issues are, in some ways is quite useful. We are having to now zero in on issues like, you know, deforestation and poor agricultural development or poor soil, you know, treatment. And these are things that you can actually do something about.
Sure. And I mean, look, at the energy transition in a whole lot of places, it might be sort of pockmarked, if you know what I mean, but it is underway. I think it's just my instinct from the letters that we've had from people and just watching the way international behaviour, you know, these international meetings behaviour, climate doesn't really seem to have its own diplomats. Can I put it like that? And I did notice in a very recent New York Times, Trump allies near total victory in wiping out US climate regulations. It's an incredible report. I mean, it'll terrify a lot of people, but it is worth reading that there have been some absolutely dogged people against going right back to when Obama basically brought in endangerment funding so that this was designed to really trigger funds when certain thresholds were reached. And a lot of people around Trump really felt that was almost, some of them thought it was a Leninist plot to undermine US capitalism. And they have not given up. And according to this New York Times report, they have never stopped and they're on the brink of achieving a great deal. So, you know, I don't know whether we need dramatic horrors in order to get a seat at the table. That's what I've been pondering, because at the moment I don't think there's really a lot of talk about climate. So, Amanda, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's really terrific to have you join us. I've loved talking to you over the years, and I did this morning too.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for your company on this Your Call episode. Do keep sending us the questions you'd like us to answer. global.roaming@abc.net.au.
I'll be back in your ears tomorrow with a very special edition of Global Roaming. We're roaming a bit further. We're going into space, actually. Our guest is Professor Brian Cox. Do not miss it. 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. on ABC Radio National, and of course, anytime on ABC Listen.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.